Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Stagecraft, Variety's theater podcast, bringing you backstage and behind the scenes with the stars, creators, and industry leaders on Broadway and beyond. I'm Gordon Cox. On this episode of Stagecraft, I'm talking to the actor Amir Arison. He recently wrapped up 9 seasons as a series regular on NBC's successful crime thriller, The Blacklist. And the very first project he took on after that brought him to Broadway. Arison now plays the lead character in The Kite Runner, the stage adaptation of the best-selling 2003 novel by Khaled Hosseini. It's a big role that spans decades and keeps Arison on stage for the entirety of the show. Now the actor is in the virtual studio with me to tell us about living and acting in the moment, exiting The Blacklist, and how his life was changed by the play My Robot Buddy. Hi, Amir. Thanks for joining me.
It is a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
So you're making your Broadway debut in The Kite Runner, and it's a heavy lift of a show, right? Like, you're on stage for the whole thing, and you tell the story, and it all centers around you. How's it been going for you?
I'm absolutely cherishing every second of this experience. There are no breaks. It has required a discipline that I've never even encountered or imagined in my life, which completely and utterly scared me. I've done challenging roles. I've been out front in plays before, but never without an exit, and never for this long, and never with this much this well-known of a story and sort of all that goes with it. And so when I got the role, I was like, oh, wow, my Broadway debut and a character whose name is the same name as mine. Yep. And then it was like, oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God, how am I going to do this? And so there was a good deal of fear, which can be healthy if you channel it the right way. And I took myself, as soon as I finished shooting, I was working on The Blacklist. As soon as I wrapped shooting this past season, I took myself to a dear friend's family's guest house in the mountains in North Carolina and cut off from social media, distractions, socializations, put my phone on Do Not Disturb and studied and wanted to get as much preparation. I told myself I'm not leaving this cabin until I've memorized all 40 narrative monologues. Until I've got as much of the accent down as I can when I'm sort of in Kabul in Act One when I'm a kid, and as much of the Dari, which is spoken in the first 2 scenes, which is the sort of the Afghan dialect of Farsi, and then as much of the sort of scene work as I could, and met with the vocal coach and Zoomed with the director, and to get as many questions and as many variables prepped as I can, so that when I enter rehearsal, it's flow, getting to know your fellow actors, responding, listening, learning the staging, getting in as much, absorbing as this, because it's a lot of information. There's no breaks. So as a result of that, and also sort of stretching and getting the mind right. And as a result, it has centered me more than I could have expected. And everybody always asks, oh my God, are you exhausted after that show? How do you do 2 a day? How do you do 8 a week? How are you going to do that again? And 2 things. I always say day by day, act by act, scene by scene, moment to moment. There is no time for me to overthink or worry. Where did that laugh go tonight? Or that scene didn't feel as vulnerable, or it doesn't matter. You tell the story and you ride on to the next moment. There is no, which has been a great lesson and a reminder in life. I don't have time to go off stage and be like, oh, why didn't that go as well? Or oh boy, I'm nervous. So-and-so's in the audience. I've got to enter with energy. You don't, none of that, it all goes away. and you just have to listen, respond, and then when I'm doing the monologues, tell the story, and that in that, and just trust life preparation, life instincts, my age, my just, you have to fall forward and trust, as fearful as that may be. And that has been so rewarding, so that when people say, "Are you tired?" I said, "Well, yes, I'm on discipline. I don't go out. I really don't. I might have dinner after the last show of the week. I might, depending on how I'm feeling. That's as much as I'll give myself. I, of course, say hello to people after the show. But so the physical and vocal toll is there. And I have to recover and rest. And I have to stretch and do consistently things that I may not have done consistently.
You're drinking hot water now, as you mentioned, for the throat. Yeah, yeah.
Then, but the mental toll, because he goes through a journey and really, you know, the character is so shame ridden and guilt ridden, and to get to that redemption, which doesn't happen to the last 5 minutes of the play, last 3 minutes of a 2.5 hour play, weirdly is sometimes energizing. So I'm physically exhausted, but sort of spiritually re-energized. And that is not something I expected, and I can't believe it. And the theater gods are, and so far have been loving to me, but I always say, I have another one tonight. You can't get too high and you can't get too low. Don't punish yourself if it doesn't feel right, and don't celebrate if it feels great. You just say, okay, wow, we did that one, and I have another one tomorrow. It's really, really special in that way. Very, very special.
You've been on stage many times before. We last saw you in New York in Waterwell's Hamlet in 2017, and we saw you the public in Why Torture is Wrong and the People Who Love Them and shows like that. But what's gratifying to you about being back on stage after, you know, whatever it's been, 5 years or so?
You know, I didn't want to do much stage anymore. I told my manager, I come from theater. I did it. But once I sort of found the love of TV, I was enjoying it. I enjoyed it that having weekends. I enjoyed, financially, it's much, much better than the theater. But you don't become an actor for the, you certainly don't become an actor for the money. And, and then, you know, something in television that's interesting too, is you, like I kind of touched upon it before, is you don't have time to overthink things. You got to learn it fast because you're shooting it in a couple of days, maybe tomorrow, maybe in a week. And then you shoot it, you do a couple of takes, and then you have to prepare for the next episode. You have to prepare for the next scene. You have to let it go and sort of trust your preparation and trust the editors. And it forced me, I think there's a theme that I was quite anxious when I was younger and quite hard on myself. So maybe TV, and maybe I'm just realizing this now, maybe sort of the 9 years I had on the blacklist that forced me to not overthink has helped me get to this point. I'm not entirely sure, but I know that Hamlet exhausted me, and the previous show I did at the was on a summer hiatus between season one and two was The Muscles in Our Toes by Stephen Belber with Labyrinth. And that show, I was also on stage the whole time, but that show was only 85 minutes and all of us were on stage together the whole time. So it was my character was more quiet. And I remember just depleting myself completely depleting myself, and not sure if the rewards outweighed the sort of the toll for some reason. This is not when I was younger, not when I was starting, something about, you know, the last few plays I've done. And I told my manager, I don't really want to do theater unless it's the perfect role with the perfect director and the perfect show. There is no such thing as perfect, but something that I have to do. Otherwise I don't, it has to be worth it to kind of put myself through that. And she said to me, it was before the season 10 had been renewed. So I was like, we're looking for a job. We didn't know if Black was going to come on. She goes, well, Kite Runner's coming to Broadway. I think you'd be right for Amir. I was like, oh, send me the script. Send me the script. I was like, oh God, this role is hard. Oh my God. I don't even like the character. I was like, how am I going to get behind this? He makes such a series of decisions that are so anathema to my soul and my vibe. He cowered and shame and guilt, which are all very challenging to play because those are inherently inactive and you want to make active choices as an actor? So how do you actively play indecision? How do you actively play internal shame? You know, there are moments where he projects it and like, but you know, and he projects it outward, which is just so painful. It's like, oh God, you know, the person who hates themselves then hates others, that sort of sage, because he hates something about themselves will then project it onto others. And I wasn't, but I was like, oh, looking for a job. And, you know, it is Broadway. I used to dream of doing Broadway. And it's like, you know, Broadway are mostly musicals. I'm not a musical guy. I'm not such a singer. I'm not a singer. All right, this role is okay. All right, I'll audition. And I still wasn't completely behind the role. And I thought my first audition, I tanked it. I completely thought it was over Zoom. I've never auditioned for theater over Zoom. And I'm trying to stand up and I'm like leaning into the Zoom camera. And then I can't unpin myself. And then like, I'm seeing other people. And like, it was just like weird. And I apologized to my manager. I apologized to my friend, my neighbor who ran lines with me. I was like, I'm sorry. Because when I teach sometimes, I teach younger actors and stuff, or do like sort of workshops and master classes. I always say, preparation is the only thing you can control. And that's as much as you control. And if you do your best, you know, and I felt like maybe I didn't prepare enough because I hadn't been completely behind the role. And I was being hard on myself because I had a very, very busy, challenging arc at the time on Blacklist. Mm-hmm. So I was up at 5 a.m. shooting all day, an arc where my character also has a mental breakdown. And so I was particularly hard on myself. And I apologized. And what I call my friend Ariel calls it, we got audition hangover, where you feel just like, oh, for a day or two, you're just like, oh, that went terrible. And, you know, and I said, well, maybe I didn't really want the role. And okay. And I let it go. And then I threw the sides into the recycling. A week later, I get a call back. I laughed for a minute when she said, you're called back. I was like, she goes, I knew you would. She goes, most of my clients that think they did terribly did well, or what you think is terrible is not terrible, but that's not for me to decide. I laughed. And I was so happy to get the call back. Not because I had attached myself to getting the part. I really was detached from it. I was a little worried about what happens if I get it. How am I going to do it? The thing that I was happy about was like, I'm getting another chance to try to do my best for me. And I went and pulled the sides out of the recycling. I hadn't taken them out that week. Recycle every 2 weeks. And they were there, which is a good thing. Mike Nichols once said, like, you know, I think Mike Nichols used to rehearse plays and then they would go away for 6 months and then come back. There's something that happens when you don't think about it or worry about it. It enters your subconscious a little bit. I had completely released and let it go, which is probably, again, another realization, the ultimate sort of lesson. I completely let it go. And I said, well, why did I not feel my best objectively without sort of self-hate? I said, well, this moment didn't work. I said, well, you know, the Zoom thing was weird. Well, forget Zoom. I'm just going to do it a table read. I'm not auditioning. I'm just going to table read this. What beats did not feel connected? Why not? Let me go back to the book and look up there. Now I have a little more time to do a little prep and I'm kinder to myself and I've already detached. And again, this callback was more for me to do my best, just to feel like I could not have that hangover. And after it was in that audition, not before it, that I discovered the love inside of him. And it was in the audition that I fell in love with the part. I still wasn't in love with the part. I was like, I know my job is to humanize these decisions, to make him understandable, you know, all these sort of horrible anti-hero decisions he makes. I understood all that. But then I found the love inside and it cracked wide open and I was making discoveries that I had never anticipated. Something about, I think, being relaxed, which is an important lesson for actors. You can be, the more prepared you are, the more relaxed you can be. And when I finished, it felt great in the conversation. You know, most of the creative team's from England. And it's very interesting. They in American theater auditions, you come in, there's not much talk, maybe a small little thing. And then you do the audition and they might give you notes and they say, thank you. Or maybe they'll talk to you after. With Giles, and I hear this is common with English directors, we talk a lot before we even read. Oh, how are you? This and that. We're talking about this. We're thinking, you know, and it just a conversation, a little bit about the show, a little bit about what they're doing, what they're looking for. And which is sort of lovely and different. And when I got off, when I finished the audition, I said, oh, I feel better. I feel like I just took a giant creative release, for lack of a better word. And I was like, oh, I'm okay, Amir. You did your best. Thank you, theater gods, for another opportunity to just kind of. And also, I had an audition for theater. Hamlet and Muscles on Our Toes were both straight offers. I had done table reads of them. So then I got offers after the table read. So this was the first theater audition I've done in a very long time. And I just wanted to sort of re-experience that and re-challenge myself in a different way. And an hour after the audition, I said, oh, wait a second. I think I might have given myself a chance to get this. Well, I might get this. Okay. Well, that would be cool. 2 days later, I got a text from my manager. You're getting the Kite Runner. And I was like, whoa.
And were you on board at that point? Definitely? As in terms of committing to it?
Yeah, I knew I was going to. Yeah. I knew I had to do it. I was scared, but I knew I had to do it. Of course, you know, that you have to go back and forth, right. Manager. There's things to talk about. There's a few little nooks and crannies of things.
What was the, do you remember the specific moment in the audition that unlocked the love in the character?
Yeah, it's really, you're going to make me emotional. I do remember the moment. Not to put you on the spot, but have you seen the show?
I have, yes.
You saw?
Of course I did. I saw it, I don't know, 2 days before it opened. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, wonderful. Well, the audition was, there were two scenes. There was one scene as a kid, when he's describing his story to Hassan about the story he wrote about the magic pearls, the magic cup. They wanted to see me as a kid, and that made sense. And then the other scene was sort of one of the I would call them, for lack of a better word, operatic scenes, if you will. It's the giant revelation where he finds out from Rahim Khan that Rahim Khan knows everything that he's done as a kid, that he's been hiding, that he didn't think anyone knew. And two, that not any spoil. If you haven't read The Kite Runner or you're planning on coming seeing it, cover your ears. This is a spoiler alert, spoiler alert, spoiler alert. But I do sense that about 70% of our audience has read the book when they come see the show, 75%. But anyway, for those who don't cover your ears, when he also discovers that his father is Hassan's father.
Right.
And so it was in that scene. And around the moment he discovers it, that as much of the frustration, how dare you, I've been dealing with this all this time, but you guys have been complicit in another arguably bigger lie, or bigger secret is a better word, not a lie, a bigger secret. And that something cracked wide open. And also inside of the moment when he finds out that Hassan's died, and I just burst with how much I loved him. It burst out in sort of a form of tears, and it just how much I loved him. And I've been burying that love for the whole play because he can't deal with it. He can't, how much he loved him, he can't face with what he did to someone he just absolutely loved, his closest and dearest friend, who turns out to also be his brother, because of his privilege and his naivety and his shame and his sort of weakness as a kid. So it was then that it was actually how much I love Hassan, not how much I hate myself. The hate myself was inherent, had been built up before. And it was like, he has so much love. And then when I thought about it after, you know, he didn't have a mom. His dad was very tough. His dad doesn't show love the way he needed it to be shown. So he had a lot of displaced love. He didn't want to, you know, that's how I try to lead life. You know, you lead with love. And I know I'm out front in this company. And I always said, when I started, I said, Amir, you got to be kind to yourself, because you got to be kind to yourself. Like, something gets messed up. If somebody drops a line, it's okay. Like, don't worry about it. And then, oh my God, Amir, I'm sorry. I messed up. It doesn't matter. There are no mistakes. It's theater. It was awesome. It was new. Tomorrow we got another one. It's awesome. And you know, the show has reminded me more than anything in my life. I can't tell you how much I cherish it. Just as a, whatever we close tomorrow, hope we don't. Hope we run. It doesn't matter. The show has given me something and taught me something that I needed.
I'll have more with Amir right after the break.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com.
And now, here's more with the actor Amir Arasan.
The Kite Runner is one of, as you mentioned, a lot of people coming to see the show will have at least, well, if not read the book, they've at least heard the title. Maybe they've seen, they made a movie in 2007 of it. Like, it is a story that is around and that most people are familiar with. Were you familiar with it? And what did it mean to you personally before you got involved in this?
I had not read the book, actually, till after I got the part. I read my sections for the callback.
Right.
I didn't have time to read it before the first audition, and I didn't know I was getting called back the next day for the callback. Didn't feel, when I thought I didn't get it, I didn't feel like reading the book at that moment.
Right. Yeah.
The story is so well known. There are sort of, I would call the sort of the main event in Act One that is sort of well known, and what that, so there's sort of the main plot. There's a lot of things in Act Two that people don't remember, even that, oh my God, I forgot that, or I forgot that happened. It's very rich.
And why do you feel like the story needs to be told right now? What is particularly resonant for it about it right now?
Well, there's a very obvious current invasion of another country that's happening right now. The Soviet Union has invaded Ukraine. In the play, the Soviet Union, after Act One, before Act Two, the Soviet Union has invaded Afghanistan. This play was decided to be put on before that happened. There was something in the zeitgeist the producers maybe had their finger on. Of course, also this past year, as we know, that we left Afghanistan, and sort of the rise of the Taliban came back. There's signs of the rise of the Taliban, the mullahs were the teachers in the beginning of the play. Even Amir's father, Baba, says to him, God help us if the country falls into their hands, you know. And Amir, my character, leaves Afghanistan with his tail between his legs. He doesn't want to look back. He doesn't want to even think about it. He wants to become an American and forget his past. We were there for 20 years and we left, and we did not leave under the ways we had hoped. And I don't mean to get political, and I know a lot of people have a lot of different point of views, but those are two facts, those two very basic facts. And the thing I love about theater, good theater, is it doesn't preach. It tells it through a human story. So here, Khaled Hosseini, the backdrop of the play is Soviet Union invaded. He's an immigrant in America, trying to find his way. The president was executed. There is the sort of the power class system, the educated, the uneducated, servants and masters, which is what it's referred to in the play. So bias, racism, class, but he doesn't comment on any of that. He just tells the story about these two best friends with a power difference. This guy without a mom and his father, him coming to America and just boy meets girl, wants to get married, falls in love. She has an overbearing father, how he has to deal with that. It's just, and each character has their own secret and their own flaw that gets unfurrowed throughout the play, or something that they're not sharing, or they're a lie. Even Hassan tells a lie to protect Amir. Says he did steal the watch and the cash. It's just like the most heartbreaking thing you can ever imagine. So the best way, in my opinion, to get people to relate or open their eyes or minds is just tell a human story. Many people know someone in their family or someone dear to them that had to immigrate to this country. Somebody knew, you know, the one of the things I did not originally love about the role is just all the weakness, for lack of a better word. But then I found out that the bravery exists in the monologues that he's confessing. which you can interpret that differently when you read the novel, but in a play, it's like, why am I telling this? What is my relationship to the audience and narrating? You know, you read a novel, it's individual. It's like, he starts with I remember the moment I became who I am today. And then that moment resurfaces 2/3 of the way later. And then he's like, now I need your help. I told you the story as far as I can go. Now I'm sort of entering the present. And he's airing his dirty laundry, if you will, and confessing and letting the truth out, which ultimately helps free him. And I just think you tell a human story, people will draw their own conclusions. But I think it is important that the backdrop is, I can hear the audience when I get to, at the very end of the play, the second to last monologue, I say, we arrived home on a warm day in August 2001. And while Sarab was silent, the world wasn't. Then one Tuesday morning, the Twin Towers fell and the world changed. America bombed Afghanistan and the Taliban scurried away like rats. I'd go into Starbucks and people would be talking about Mazar-i-Sharif and Kabul and the cities of my childhood. And during all of this, Sarab didn't say a word. It's about Sarab, but and I can feel the audience 3 minutes before the end of the play go, I can feel them go, oh, which is when I feel like many Americans sort of woke up to Afghanistan. What is Afghanistan? Where is Afghanistan? Who lives in Afghanistan? What is the Taliban? What is Osama bin Laden? What is our policy, foreign policy? And so you can feel like we took this on a 26-year journey, and then they join us, and they join Amir just for the end when he finally steps up. It's you can feel it. So they're on just a human story, and then they say, hey, guess what? That was 2001, and now we're in 2022. How much has changed? What's happening? Unfortunately, things are, you know, quite troubling.
Yeah. Do you know how to fly a kite? It sounds really hard. The competition, the kite fighting competition. It seems like a skill that I will never have.
I hadn't flown kites. We had a kite flying rehearsal. We all met in Central Park.
Yep.
It was a very bonding thing. We all met in Central Park, and they got a few kites.
Oh.
And I ran one, and I had Hassan. Hassan ran nice. One, and we ran them together, and it was such a fun day for the company. But those aren't the same kites that are being flown in Afghanistan back, you know. And Farhan, who plays Baba, you know, who grew up in Pakistan, there were a lot of kite fighting tournaments, there was like an hour where he just kind of talked to us about that. And, you know, the main difference is that the string is quite sharp because the string is put through glass and glue. So you're actually, it's like sword fighting.
Is that
kites.
Why it's sharp? I did not know
that. Did you miss that?
I missed that part. Yeah,
line.
Yeah.
I'm going to hit that
Please
line.
Please do. Yeah, yeah. I knew clearly something was happening with that string, but.
Our glass, me and Hassan, our glass-coated cutting line, our bullet in the chamber ready.
Yeah.
I go out into the field and feed 500 feet of string through a mixture of ground glass and glue. And that's why it slices fingers forth.
Wow.
So it's a.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you are not, you yourself are not a champion kite fighter, but.
No, and I've also not. I've never held a glass-coated. Oh, you know what's funny? In Central Park, even without the glass, I got a paper cut slice on, you know, the sort of where your finger, the crease in your fingers are, like at the top of my forefinger. I remember being like, ow, ooh, ow. And I got a paper cut. And I was like, oh, can you imagine what? And then Fran told us that, you know, many people are wearing bandages all over their fingers and hands as a badge of honor to how long they were in the tournament, how good they were, and how much they sacrificed.
Yeah.
It's really, really unique.
Yeah. Rewinding just a little bit to talk about how you first got started in performing. I have read that you delivered 2 lines in your 2nd grade play and your mother decided you had talent and signed you up for drama club. So my question is, what were the 2 lines?
Oh God, I was a pirate.
Excellent.
I don't remember what they were. I do remember the line where I knew I was going to be an actor, which was in the 6th grade in a play called My Robot Buddy. I knew
that
I was
like, my next question is when you decided to be an actor. Great. Excellent.
Oh,
well done.
Oh, I joined drama club when I was 8. No, 2nd grade. Yeah, 8. The 3rd grade I joined. I was 2nd grade. But my mom came up to me after those 2 lines and just looked at me and goes, you have talent. And I was great at sports, just like Amir in the play. Not great at soccer like his dad wants to be. He wrote poetry. And so that's a big way I related into the play, actually. A big way. Him wanting to be an artist and, you know, his dad not sure if it's the best. My dad is much more supportive and loving than Baba, but my dad was not sure if it was a safe profession. He's super into it now. And I have to say, actually, I felt a lot lighter. This is so funny to say. I could also get emotional. When I started the process, I just wanted my dad to be proud of me. My mom is just like, I could like sneeze and she's proud of me. But you know, my dad is the best. Like, please know that there's nothing disparaging about this, but I didn't realize I wanted to get to opening physically, vocally, mentally, all of that, and have my dad come to opening night and the show to just work on opening night for my dad to see that. And that was the best, the best. And I felt lighter the next day. I felt a lot lighter since, significantly lighter. It's like, whatever happens, like, my dad got to see me on Broadway, you know, and it was all going to be okay. And then I decided when I was 12, I was going to be an actor. It's okay.
What was the line? Wait, what was the line? And when you were 12?
Okay, I don't remember that. I don't remember the two pirate lines, because that was like, I don't even, but in my Robot Buddy, I played a—
That's an excellent title.
I played a doctor. It's a great play. It's a great little play. It was about a kid who hires this machine, this doctor to build a robot friend, to build the best friend. Oh my God, I didn't even realize the parallel with the Kite Runner. He wants a best friend, you know, and so Dr. Atkins was my character's name, built a robot that will do everything with him. He can run, jump, climb, and he's like, he has a new best friend, a robot best friend. But the kid goes, but I just want him to be happy. Oh my God, this is getting quite profound. I haven't thought about this in a while. I just want him to be happy. And the doctor never made dispositions. He just made robots to do whatever you wanted to do with the kid, play catching him. And he goes, happy? We don't do this. And the kid goes, you mean you can't do it? And I remember saying, for some reason, something inside of me goes, if I go up with my inflection on this line, it's going to get a laugh. I don't know where that came from. He goes, can't. I said, I think the character had some kind of faux intellectual accent, almost like a Fraser Crane or a Niles Crane. It wasn't quite, I don't know where that came from. I go, Cod, there's nothing I can't do, you know, whatever. And I remember doing Kant and I get a little laugh, and it was lower school audiences, grades like kindergarten through sixth grade, and they start chuckling, and then I do it again, and then they chuckle some more. And then I got this big roaring laugh. And at that moment, I was like, oh yeah, this is what I do. Sure. It was a drug. I was like, oh, this is a high. Yeah. And it came instinctively. Mm-hmm. And so yeah, that's what I was like, oh, I want to be an actor. And then when I graduated college, I was like, oh, you got to keep this promise to yourself. Oh, let me get backstage newspaper and start sending in headshots and taking workshops and doing off Broadway plays and getting one line on a soap opera and just beginning, mm-hmm. and just seeing what would happen.
And so you were on the blacklist for 9 seasons, and it's been picked up for a 10th season, but you will not be a part of that season. Is that right? What led to that decision?
Okay. So, to be careful what I say here. My character was not killed off. So there is a potential for me to be back in season 10, but I'm not a series regular. I'm not, certainly not there for the bulk of the season. I'm not a functioning sort of cog in the machine of the storytelling or of the case solving. So that's a maybe. I'll just tease that. It really is a maybe. So it depends on storyline and schedules and lots of things. So they left that as a possibility for me and for them, which makes me so happy, because who knows what happens in life. Also, I didn't want to unceremoniously die because I took a Broadway show. Right. the decision, again, when I got the job, we had not been offered a season 10 yet. It's really crazy how tight it came that the show got renewed, and then they called us, and just like a week or two before that, I had gotten the Kite Runner. And so when I got the Kite Runner, I said, oh wow, now I have a— I knew that I was— there was no decision. I had been doing that for so long, and this was an immense challenge. And I was like, I'm an actor. I have to challenge myself and scare myself. And the Broadway dream came back. It boomeranged back. I had let it go. And who knew? I think Kite Runner is the only play right now. I think there's maybe another play. The Minute's just closed, but it's mostly musicals. I know plays are coming, but there's one or two plays right now. Yeah. The fact that I got an opportunity to play the lead, and it's such a beloved story. So it was really not— it was like a no brainer. It was just hard to say goodbye to the best job I ever had, the blacklist. But you know, I mean, my dream when Broadway wasn't happening, my dream was to get on a quality series. Never expected it to go 9 years, much less 10, much less more than five. Most shows don't go, hit shows don't go more than three or four seasons now. So I feel like that dream manifested and then some and then some. And then all of a sudden this other dream came boomeranging back and says, well, a chance to have two dreams come true. Come on now. I'm the luckiest kid in the world.
And what do you hope to do going forward?
I'll tell you very clearly, tonight's show. Tonight's show. And I'm dead serious. I that is the only way to approach this material for me, and has been something that I've been sort of teaching myself in life. So I am curious, you know, what my next job would be, but my next job is tonight's show. You know, I gotta, you know, it really, really, really that simply. And, you know, if you do your best, things often can work out in better ways than you hope even. But if not, I got to do this. Who knows? Who knows? I just want to get to tomorrow. We have a long run. Until October 30th. That sort of depends on how you look at it. But it's a long run to do this role, you know, eight shows a week. I don't know. I don't know how many we've done. We've done like 28 or 29 or 30 of them. We have like another 100 to go. Yeah. So one by one.
Well, we look forward to seeing what comes next after that. And in the meantime, break a leg tonight.
Thank you so, so much. What a delight to talk to you.
Yeah, you too. Thanks, Amir.
Thank you.
That was Amir Arison, now starring on Broadway in The Kite Runner. If you like what you're hearing on this and other episodes of Stagecraft, I'd really appreciate it if you took the time to rate and review us wherever you listen to podcasts. It really helps us grow our audience of folks who love theater as much as you and I do. Or tell a friend about Stagecraft. Or give us a shout-out on social media. Find past episodes and subscribe at all the pod purveyors, including Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and on the Broadway Podcast Network, which is a great place to find more theater for your ears. Until next episode, find me on Twitter at @GCoxVariety. Thanks for listening, and see you at the theater.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.